Well, welcome everyone. You're really in for a treat. I'm super excited to introduce you to Faith Hillis, who I've known for many, many years now. Kind of met back at Stanford, I think, in 2003. So Faith was an undergraduate at Stanford and went on and got her PhD at Yale, where she worked with Laura Engelstein. We actually shared the same graduate advisor. And she's just published a really wonderful book, which is she's going to be presenting on today, Children of Rus, Right Bank Ukraine and the Invention of a Russian Nation. She's been the recipient of numerous awards from ACLS, NCIR, SSRC. She's given all kinds of presentations, and she's also at work now on a new project that I had the pleasure of hearing a talk based off of it at a conference recently, and she's going to give a paper tomorrow at the Russian History Kruzhok on it, which I invite you all to. If anyone's interested, I can give you the information later. So she is moving now in a direction from talking about Russian nationalism and Russia and Ukraine to thinking more broadly about Russia and its relationship with Europe and these emigre communities in France in particular, which I'll be presenting on tomorrow. So I'll let you hear it from her and just turn it over to Faith.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Thanks. Thank you so much to Fran for the introduction, to Jennifer and everyone from Krika for these amazing accommodations. I've only been here for a few hours, but the welcome has already been very warm in spite of the frosty temperatures outside, so it's my pleasure. So what I'm going to talk about today is a nationalist movement that transformed everyday life and politics on the extreme periphery of the Russian Empire over the course of the long 19th century. And you see this region circled here, this area that I'm talking about. This is a region called Right Bank Ukraine. Otherwise put, it's the west side of the Dnieper River, so moving west from the Dnieper River to the Austrian border. And today, this region is the heart of the independent nation of Ukraine. But then, in the 19th century, what I'm talking about today, it comprised what the imperial authorities called the southwestern borderlands. And this is a close-up here of these three provinces that I'm talking about. Now, for those of you who have some familiarity with this region, you probably think that you've heard this story before and you already know what I'm going to talk about. This region was acquired from the Polish state only in the late 18th century when the Polish state was partitioned by the great powers, and it was one of the Russian Empire's most diverse corners in the 19th century. It was populated primarily by Polish-speaking Catholics, by Yiddish and Russian-speaking Jews, and by Ukrainian-speaking peasants, most of whom were of the Orthodox faith. Well into the 19th century, even into the 20th, you could argue, it maintained very weak ties to the Russian heartland. So according to the 1897 census, this is a region where only 4% of the local population claims Russian as its first language. Now, the narrative of this region, with which you're probably most familiar, centers on the national awakenings of these groups that live in this area, Poles, Jews, and Ukrainians, and then their mobilization against the Tsarist Empire. But the story that I'm going to reconstruct today focuses on a fourth movement, whose importance actually really dwarfed the influence of any of these other national movements, and this was a Russian nationalist movement. The Russian nationalists of the Southwest treated the East Slavs, by which they meant Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, as creators and as the titular nationality of the Russian Empire. And they pursued a nationalizing agenda in two respects. First of all, they argued that East Slavs and East Slavs alone should play the dominant role in the empire's politics, and therefore that the influence of other groups in the empire should be reduced. And then secondly, they pursued a democratizing agenda. So these Russian nationalists treated workers and peasants as valued members of a Russian nation, no less than, say, priests or nobles. Now, most historians who've grappled with the question of Russian nationalism in the late imperial period have emphasized its failures, right? It's very difficult to learn how to adapt ethnic national ideas to this multi-ethnic empire that has 300 plus ethnicities and nationalities. And by the same token, this democratizing agenda that seems to be at the very heart of what nationalism is would seem to undermine the very foundations of the autocratic system. Yet, this seemed not to be a problem with this southwestern Russian nationalism, which very high-ranking Tsarist officials embraced, thereby allowing it to flourish. By 1907, Russian nationalism had become utterly dominant in the region's street politics and in its formal political institutions. And by 1910, it gained all imperial influence as Southwestern activists convinced high-ranking officials of the potential of their program to save the empire. And I'll talk about this evolution over the course of this talk. So this is the chief question that I'm asking today, right? How was it that this diverse and peripheral region, a place that's virtually devoid of people whom we today would identify as Russians, came to lead the Russian Empire on a search for a Russian nation? And what made activists and officials come to see this particular nationalist movement as something that could be compatible with the multi-ethnic and autocratic state? Now, before I begin to get into the narrative, I want to back up and consider why my account of nation building, and actually why I'm even able to see these Russian nationalists, this is a rather different account than others have made. And I contend that plenty of the existing literature on the region takes things for granted that perhaps we shouldn't take for granted. And these are things that I contend have actually made it quite difficult to understand what's at stake in this region. So the first thing that it's often take for granted is the very existence of nationalism, right? So this goes back to this constructivist school, right? Nations as a natural and ineluctable part of the modern world. This perspective largely ignores the many challenges that face the peddlers of national ideas in the Russian Empire and in other contexts as well, we might add. And these are challenges that we might think would be particularly intense in the southwestern borderland, given that this is one of the Russian Empire's poorest, most rural, and least developed regions. The second thing that's often taken for granted is the notion that national identifications are stable and self-evident. So the way that these movements in this region are often told is Ukrainians are obviously Ukrainians, right? It's just a question of when they kind of reach consciousness of their Ukrainianness. By contrast, rather than tracing the fortunes of clear-cut and well-defined national awakenings, I ask sort of more meta questions. How did national thought become possible in the first place? How were groups constituted? And then how did groups change how they conceived of themselves over time? I think by asking these more open-ended questions, we can then solve the mystery of these Russian nationalists on the empire's southwestern periphery, while at the same time gaining a new perspective on the Russian Empire and its politics. I'm going to suggest today that perhaps it was easier to reconcile local peculiarities with imperial governance than we've once thought. And I'm going to argue as well that obscure activists on an imperial periphery could play a real role in shaping politics and identities, not only in their own region, but across the empire. So to narrate this story today, I'm going to tell the story in sort of three snapshots that illustrate various aspects of this story. And we'll dive right into our first snapshot here, which deals with this question of how national thought becomes possible in the first place. And we have to look quite far into the distant past to understand this question. It's very important to note that all East Slavs look to their origins in the Rus state, which is a trading empire that's founded in the 9th century but has its apex in the 12th century. And the capital of this state, marked by the star on this image, is the city of Kiev. And you'll note that the state stretches from what is today Poland and Romania into central Russia. Now, this Rus state, from its very origin, is multicultural. It's founded by Vikings. It includes Jews, Turkic peoples, and animist and pagan populations from the steppe. It gets its language from Greek missionaries. It gets its faith in 988 Eastern Orthodoxy from Byzantium. And just keep all of this in mind, because this comes important later. By the early modern period, this territory was ruled by a Catholic state, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. As this Polish state moved into these lands, Polish Catholic nobles began to migrate east en masse, establishing a feudal order. In this system, Orthodox peasants were tied to huge agricultural estates that were owned by primarily Polish-speaking Catholic gentry. And these estates, important to note, were largely managed by Jews. Orthodox serfs began to run away from this system of serfdom that's consolidating here to the eastern reaches of the Commonwealth, the very edges here in the southeast, where they begin to constitute a new Cossack society. Cossacks are essentially free, self-regulating military forces who serve as armies for hire for the Muscovite Tsar, for the Polish king, as well as for other powers. Now, by the 17th century, these Cossacks, who were coalescing here on the edges of this Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, began pressing the Polish kings for more rights. And these rights happened to coincide with religious grievances. Eventually, the Cossacks come to identify with the Orthodox faith. And of course, we're now in the 17th century. This is the age of Counter-Reformation. So the plight of Orthodox believers in this Catholic state is becoming worse. And so these tensions between these Cossack encampments on the southeastern fringe of the Commonwealth and the Polish kings continue to build over the 17th century until 1648, when they explode. In this year, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, whom you see here, a Cossack general, organizes a huge revolt against the Commonwealth. And he riles up peasants along the way as he pushes Polish gentry and estate managers far, far to the west. Now, in the midst of this violence, Khmelnytsky develops an expansive ideological justification for his war. And this is where Rus comes in, because it's precisely the Rus state to which he looks. In the course of this military campaign, he declares himself the Prince of Rus and names it as his mission to, quote, restore Rus traditions that Poles and Catholics had supposedly defiled. Along the way, he frames himself as the protector of all Orthodox believers. So he's also insisting that Orthodox believers share common political interests, common social interests, as well as this common Rus heritage. Now, in many cases, for Khmelnytsky and his forces, protecting Orthodox believers also entailed violence, right? So this war also witnesses horrific attacks on Catholics, on Greek Catholics. I can't get into them now, but suffice it to say they're there as well, and on Jews. Now, if we go back to what I just said about the Rus state, Khmelnytsky's claims here are rather disingenuous, right? As we saw, the Rus state was a diverse polity of many faiths and peoples, and the Cossack revolt in its origins had as much to do with the corporate interests of this Cossack estate as it did with the welfare of the Orthodox peasantry. But nevertheless, in the course of this revolt, this idea begins to stick that Cossacks represent all the children of Rus, who are also defined as Orthodox believers. Now, as a result of this war, the Cossacks take control of the east side of the Dnieper River. This is a region that's referred to in Ukrainian history as the Left Bank. And the Cossacks eventually establish a polity called the Hetmanate under the protection of the larger Orthodox power of Muscovy to the north. So here you see the Cossack Hetmanate. Muscovy, which later becomes the Russian Empire, of course, also traces its origins to this Rus state. Now, it's a tendency of scholars today to view the Hetmanate as a sort of proto-Ukrainian state. Indeed, Orthodox clerics and Cossack officers who dominated this polity celebrated the region's unique traditions, and they declared Kiev the center of Slavic civilization and of the entire Orthodox world. But what is less commonly remarked upon is that this proud loyalism firmly insisted that the Rus lands were fundamentally indivisible. These Cossacks and clerics also clearly pledged their loyalty to the Muscovite Tsar, who the Hetmanate's clerics designated as the rightful heir to the ancient princes of Kiev. So we're getting in this Hetmanate this very curious melding of imperial loyalty and Orthodox unity with this notion that Kiev, by virtue of its ties to Rus, is really the center of Slavic civilization rather than some periphery. By the late 18th century, the Hetmanate lost its autonomous status, and the Left Bank became fully incorporated into the Russian Empire. Nevertheless, the culture of this Hetmanate and its unique blend of imperialism and localism remain very much alive in the Left Bank. The descendants of Cossack generals became absorbed into the all-imperial Russian nobility. And these men proudly called themselves Little Russians, which they saw as an allusion to their kind of illustrious past and these Cossack ancestors to whom they traced their lineage. So in addition to this economic wealth that they enjoyed as official nobles now, they also held a lot of cultural capital. They gathered Cossack tales. They promoted the idea that their ancestors were the true inheritors of Rus traditions and the true defenders of all Orthodox believers. And by the early 19th century, Little Russian nobles' romantic fascination with the feats of their Cossack forefathers began to develop into what we might consider a modern national project. This text, Historia Rusov, or History of the Rus People, is incredibly important in the development of national ideas in this region. It was circulated first in oral tradition in the early 19th century, and then this is the first printed version in 1846. This text provided a comprehensive history of the Orthodox children of Rus who traced their descent to the Kievan state, and it detailed their historical struggles against enemies. But this concept of community was by now evolving from a purely religious community into an ethno-national one. The author of this text does define Rus people in this older tradition as Orthodox believers, but he also defines them as a nation that's identified by its East Slavic tongue and its common cultural traditions. The author of this text also presents Poles and Jews as members of equally coherent nations, nations that have allegedly struggled for centuries to destroy the East Slavs and their traditions. So in this work, the Cossack Wars of the 17th century are reimagined as national wars that aim, and I'm quoting here from this text, to cleanse Little Russian cities and villages of the Polish administration and of Jewry, and to resurrect in them older customs and freedoms based on the law and the customs of the Rus people, Ruski, with one S is the word used here. Now, again, often this text is treated as a manifesto of early Ukrainian nationalism. It does celebrate special Cossack traditions, and it bemoans the imperial state's absorption of the Hetmanate into this all-imperial culture. But as the quote above indicates, the central focus of this text is not, in fact, the tensions between Cossack tradition and imperial centralization. Rather, it treats Little Russia as a, Little Russia is the word it uses too, as a citadel of the Rus lands, and as the battleground from which the struggle to defend the East Slavic cultural heritage from foreign forces is ongoing. And from now on, I'm going to call this whole complex of beliefs that we see emerging from this text, right? The idea that the Southwest is a spiritual center of Rus and the place where its fate will be decided, I'm going to call this complex of idea the Little Russian idea as a sort of shorthand. So rather than a polemic against a center, I read this text as a creative effort by the periphery to change the terms of the debate, to transform religious identities into ethno-national identities, and to portray the East Slavs or the Rus people as locked in this struggle for survival on their own homeland. In the late 18th century, Russia colluded with Prussia and Austria to destroy that Polish state, and it then continued its march west, claiming the right bank of the Dnieper River. So this is the point at which these borderlands that are the focus of my story become part of the Russian Empire. Yet, the new Russian imperial overlords were completely uninterested in this Little Russian idea that had coalesced among this left bank gentry descended from the leaders of the Hetmanate. Indeed, Russian imperial officials at first left the local nobility completely intact, despite the fact that it was 95% Polish-speaking and Catholic. And it allowed Jews who had traditionally, privileged Jews who had traditionally enjoyed connections with this Polish elite, basically to maintain their social status. In short, at this point, imperial officials were far more interested in equating Russia with the Tsar and with the state than with any kind of ethno-national idea of Russianness. But this all changed very rapidly in the 1830s, and this is a point at which the Little Russian idea suddenly begins to gain official sanction. Why does this happen in the 1830s? Well, in 1830 and 31, Polish nobles in the western borderlands joined together to rally against the imperial state in an effort to resurrect that Polish nation that had been killed off by the imperial powers. The revolt was put down, but just 30 years later, again in 1863, an even more serious and widespread Polish revolt broke out. In the aftermath of these insurrections, the Russian imperial state launched an ambitious ideological campaign to claim the right bank, this largely still Polish region, for the empire. And this campaign was one that entailed containing Polish culture, on the one hand, and enhancing the status of Russian language and of orthodoxy, on the other hand. This policy is often described in the literature as Russification, and it's frequently presented as oppressive, as driven from above, as imposing the culture and interests of the center at the expense of those of the periphery and the local communities that we find there. What is less often remarked upon, though, is the fact that this so-called Russification campaign in the right bank, it is completely driven by Little Russians who migrate to the right bank after this revolt and begin colluding with this campaign to claim this area as primordially Rus land. And this is, again, the language that they are using. Now, in the process, they constitute the right bank's first Orthodox elite, right? Because as I've suggested, it was still extremely Polish at this point. So what do these left bank nobles who've now moved to the right bank do? They form historical societies that begin literally unearthing Rus, right? So they're doing these archaeological digs, digging up these churches, these fortifications from this ancient Rus state. So this is one that is unearthed in the 1830s. This is the Golden Gate. It was part of the original fortifications from Rus, and you can still see it today, sort of restored beyond recognition in Kiev if you go there. These local activists also cooperated with the imperial state to erect a statue of Saint Vladimir. That's the Rus leader who led the Russian, who led the Rus people to convert to Orthodoxy in 988. So they install this statue towering over the banks of the river, right, and very symbolically claiming the right bank for Orthodoxy for Rus. In 1843, the Governor General of Kiev founded the Kiev Commission for the Collection of Ancient Documents. And I'll refer to this group from henceforth as the Kiev Commission to keep things short and easy. This group was charged with coordinating the activities of these ad hoc antiquity and historical clubs that had arisen in the 1830s. And initially, it focused on consolidating noble registers across this region, which was an effort to prevent Poles from claiming additional noble statuses, right? If you have the records, they can't claim their status. But gradually, it embraced a broader mandate to catalog the primordial aspects of local culture that supposedly predated Polish rule. And in essence, this meant cataloging the folk cultures of what was then called the Little Russian Ukrainian-speaking peasantry. By the 1850s, the commission went further still, declaring the need to reclaim the Rus lands for the Orthodox East Slavs, and even celebrating popular resistance against Poles and Jews throughout history as national liberation movements. Right, so I just want to emphasize that this is a state institution under the Governor General of a Rusifying Kiev that is promoting this radically nationalist and socially emancipatory program. We're rewriting history as this kind of undying cycle of ethnic animosities, and we're actually praising peasant revolts, right, in this official historical commission. Now, although I'm contending that the so-called Russification offered Little Russian patriots a new opportunity to spread their ideas, I'm in no means arguing that these opportunities were unlimited. They were not. The rules of the game demanded that the expression of Little Russian particularities and their celebration take place in official settings only and never in private circles, as these young men found out. From left to right, these are Pantaleimon Kulish, Taras Shevchenko, and Nikolai Kostomarov, all heroes of the Ukrainian national canon. In the 1840s, these guys, all of whom were commission members of that official commission under the Governor General, they get busted by the police for organizing a private discussion circle that is essentially continuing the work of the commission. This is called the Kirill and Methodius Society, if you're familiar with this history. The police destruction of this group created a great deal of controversy among local officials. Many rightly noted that its discussions, in fact, echoed ideas that the Kiev Commission had discussed in public and even had printed with the okay of the imperial censors. But police officials ultimately decided that they must be punished lest their actions be emulated by others. Most of them were sentenced to terms of exile in government offices and provincial locales. Shevchenko got a far more onerous sentence because he had these lines in his poems insulting Tsar Nicholas I. Now, as I mentioned, this episode is a centerpiece of Ukrainian intellectual history, often cited as the most egregious example of the imperial effort to suppress local initiative and local culture. But again, I'm suggesting the story is more complex. By the 1850s, all three of these men had completed their sentences and coalesced in St. Petersburg, where they actually gained more prominence and more support from the authorities than they'd ever enjoyed before. They launched a Ukrainian language and Russian journal, Osnova, the first kind of Ukrainian language publication of its sort in the Russian Empire. They formed ethnographic discussion groups, and they organized Ukrainian language schools. So this is an example of a Ukrainian language primer that Kulish himself wrote in 1857. And perhaps most remarkably, they were commissioned by the imperial authorities on the occasion of the emancipation of the serfs in 1861 to translate this emancipation manifesto into Ukrainian. So to reiterate, imperial officials placed certain limits on the expression of Little Russian patriotism. But they were also rapidly becoming reliant on the Little Russian idea to claim the borderlands for the empire and to prove that the Southwest was truly Russian space rather than a Polish province. And this only became more true, this dependency, after that second Polish revolt in 1863. And here I'm going to pick up the story of a family that will help us gain some insight into how this complicated relationship between Little Russian activists and the authorities plays out post-1863. And this family is named the Shulgin family. This is Vitaly Shulgin, the family patriarch, who, like so many of these Little Russian activists, trace his ancestry to the Cossacks. Born in the left bank, he moved to Kiev to study history in 1838. So once again, this left to right bank migration right around 1830. He became a professional historian and a member of that Kiev Commission I've already alluded to so many times. But he argued that the historical commissions alone were not enough to wrest Kiev from Polish power. And he founded the city's first daily newspaper, the Kievan, in 1864. So this is this moment of crisis, right? Right after that second Polish revolt, and the authorities, imperial authorities, step in and very happily fund this newspaper. It's the highest circulating organ in the region by far and remains Kiev's main daily until 1917. The right-hand man of Shulgin was a self-made man, again, of Little Russian origin, Dmitry Pikhno. He's born into a peasant family. He's from the right bank, so he's of a much more modest social status. And he's actually educated in one of those very early Ukrainian language schools that's founded by those dedicated activists in the late 50s. He goes on to earn a PhD in economics, and therefore really, I think, embodying this dream of social mobility for peasants that Little Russian activists are beginning to champion. The paper that these two men produced, the Kievan, here you see what it looks like, it was a rather strange beast. It was published in Russian, which was the language of educated culture, and it pledged its undying loyalty to the empire and its unity. However, it also celebrated Little Russian culture and the unique language of the Ukrainian lands. And it repeatedly called on peasants to liberate themselves from Poles and Jews, whom it claimed had dominated and exploited them for centuries. Eager to spread his message beyond the small urban elite who could read this paper, Shulgin and his associates began to author picture books to familiarize illiterate peasants with the heroes of Little Russian history. And here again, we have this heavy history repeatedly coming back. So the heroes of these picture books are the princes of Rus, the Cossacks, so on and so forth. And these picture books also very explicitly urge these peasants to emulate their forebears' example in supposedly struggling against these foreign interests. Perhaps the most notorious example of these men to shape a broader consciousness, this time in the city of Kiev, has to do with this statue. Shulgin and his friends tried to erect a monument to Khmelnytsky, that 17th century Cossack general, in front of Kiev's oldest church, which predictably was built by Vladimir in the Rus period. This monument showed Khmelnytsky, it's hard to see in this picture, it's kind of happening in the back, but he is trampling a Polish standard, you see under his hooves, with the bodies of a Polish noble, a Jesuit priest, and a Jew falling off the cliff there in the back. Right, so this is a very strong statement about who belongs in this city and who doesn't, who's us and who's not us. And this is actually one of those cases where the Tsar intervened and said, this is going way too far, this can incite violence. So this statue does not go up, the figures are axed, and instead the image of the horseman alone goes up in 1888. Again, you can still see it in Kiev today. So I've just tried to offer a sort of cognitive history of East Slavic nationalism in the right bank. I've shown how out of this very diverse patchwork of people and empire, local elites began to imagine competing collectives struggling for control of the borderlands, a region that they insisted would determine the fate of all the children of Rus. This collective was first defined in religious terms, and then in ethno-national terms, and then it took on these kind of populist political dimensions. And although the state was constantly struggling to manage this Little Russian idea, it also remained dependent on it to claim this region for the empire. But all of these developments that I've discussed so far remain in the realm of high intellectual history. So how does this concept of a Rus nation mediated by this Little Russian idea begin to attract a popular following? To understand that, we're going to zoom now in on the second snapshot, which focuses on the city of Kiev, which is the capital of the southwestern borderlands in the 1880s and 90s. I argue that it's actually urban concerns that begin to give national ideas staying power and that allow activists to reach broader segments of the population. So as this official depolonization, Russification, whatever we want to call it, as this campaign is unfolding against the borderlands, Kiev was rapidly developing into a major metropolis. In the 1850s and 60s, it experienced an intense industrial takeoff, becoming the center of an extremely lucrative sugar industry. So you see a picture here from the main streets. You note the kind of European appearance, stores in many languages, hard to see, and sort of it looks like a nice place, right? It looks like a place we'd like to shop and we'd like to live. And it's worth noting that it was not the Poles who played the role, the traditional landed elite who played the key role in this industrial takeoff. Rather, it was Jews. Already by the 1870s, Jews constituted 95% of the city's most elite merchantry. And for Russianists, I'm referring to merchants of the First Guild. So these are 95% Jewish. And of these Kiev merchants, this is Lazar Brodsky. He kind of became the image of them all. You can read about him caricatured in the writings of Sholem Aleichem. He ran the city's powerful sugar cartel and was really a main figure in urban politics. Now, as I've suggested, because of the immense influence of these elites, despite their less privileged confessional status, Jewish entrepreneurs enjoyed a remarkable influence in high politics. These are men who routinely would dine with the Tsar, with foreign ministers whenever they came to town, things like this. And they also left their imprint on the urban built environment and on the transformation of Kiev into a modern European metropolis. It was Jewish mercantile elites who founded private utility companies in the late 19th century that provided the city with water, electricity, and sewer service. And they even a transit company, right? Kiev hosts the Russian Empire's first electric tram in 1894. You see it here. This company, too, is owned by a major Jewish entrepreneur. I'm going to return to this scene because this very square is today European Square, and it's the site of the standoff that's occurring in Kiev to this day. So there's this great capitalist boom in Kiev, but with capitalist booms, of course, come inequality. Workers began flooding into the city, doubling its population every decade. And as you began to have those rich European-style stores springing up in the city center, you were also getting worker ghettos in the periphery. We see a picture here of one of the outskirts, one of these peripheral neighborhoods. These were extremely unpleasant places that had among the highest mortality rates in the entire Russian Empire. These are places that had no sewage, no electricity, no tram service, and where people lived alongside farm animals. In 1870, Kiev, like other cities in European Russia, was granted the right to elect a city council called a Duma, which oversaw issues related to infrastructure, economic development, and education. Suffrage was limited to the very wealthy, which offered Kiev's remaining Polish nobles and these Jewish mercantile elites a prominent role in this institution. Once in the Duma, Kiev's multi-ethnic city fathers basically used it to defend their own class privileges and their business interests. So they would lower their own taxes. They would prevent their business competitors from opening industry in the city. And in fact, the single largest public works project that this Duma undertook in 1870 to 1917 period is a building for itself. This is the Kiev Municipal Duma. So by contrast, these city fathers showed very little interest in the welfare of the population at large. And so this gap between rich and poor only continued to widen. Now, these patterns of inequality that I've just described were endemic to all cities in Imperial Russia, actually in the Western world, we can say. But we get a particular critique of inequality in Kiev, where there's already this very well-established nationalist narrative of little guys suffering at the hands of fat cats, as it were. Shulgin and Pikhno's paper, The Kievan, eagerly seized on this urban crisis. It began to publish muckraking articles about the problems of the urban periphery, about the suffering of workers, about the injustices of capitalist society and the indolence of the city fathers. It didn't, however, present these problems as generic side effects of rapid growth or of capitalism. Rather, it presented them as evidence of a long-running Jewish plot to oppress Orthodox East Slavs. And this is a plot that, as always, was projected far into the past. So it's at precisely this moment that that Kiev Commission is still spinning out its histories, both elite and popular. It's at this moment that Jews actually began to supplant Poles as kind of the chief villain in these historical accounts that this group is always writing. Now, I just want to be clear here that this idea of Jewish domination, right, this is a fantasy. Most Jews who live in Kiev are very, very poor. People like the Brodskys, right, are very rare. Most Jews in Kiev are living and working alongside Orthodox factory workers and artisanal workers in those terrible outlying neighborhoods that I showed you. But of course, this is always elided in these narratives. By the last years of the 19th century, this combination of a progressive social agenda, a kind of muckraking quality, with exclusionary anti-Semitism, this combination begins to transcend rarefied intellectual circles and to become a really ingrained part of urban discourse. By the 1890s, a new generation of Orthodox professionals, these are people like doctors, lawyers, and teachers, these people began to win seats in this municipal Duma, and they do particularly well on that urban periphery. Once in power, these men echo the notion that Jews in particular are to blame for the urban inequalities and dysfunctions so evident in urban life. And they get particularly exercised about the sugar cartel that Brodsky runs and also those municipal utilities companies that I talked about before. Gradually, these urban crusaders begin to reach deeper and deeper down into society, aiming to rile up even those who can't vote. And I should say that only about 5% of the urban population does have the franchise at this time. These populist Duma delegates began to organize rallies and grassroots meetings on the urban periphery to protest the conduct of the city fathers, especially the Jews among them. And they claim all the while to defend the ordinary Orthodox people. So, by 1900, intellectuals like Shulgin and Pikhnow and these demagogic Duma deputies who were working in league with them, they began to give these rather abstract ideas of nationhood real-world applications. They take these very genuine urban concerns and weave them into narratives of historical suffering and political resistance. And they learn to use political institutions and neighborhood meetings, things that we would generally associate with civil society, against a group that they deem other. So we've seen how local politicians who are simultaneously anti-liberal and populist are beginning to make this new program, right, that can connect urban grievances to these national concerns. But we've seen very little thus far now of the people in whose names these activists are continually speaking. And they enter in our third snapshot, to which I'll turn now. And this has to do with the development of mass politics between 1900 and 1910 in this region. Around 1900, waves of social protest emerged across the Russian Empire. And by 1905, these movements had coalesced into a full-fledged revolutionary movement. Across the empire, the Tsar's subjects took to the streets in strikes and in protests, and by fall, they managed to elicit major political concessions from the Tsar. The catchphrase of 1905 across the Russian Empire was liberation. And in most cases, this meant liberation from the Tsarist regime and equal civil rights for all. Many did embrace this definition of liberation in Kiev. The Jewish mercantile elites, to whom I've alluded, played a particularly visible role in the struggle to attain equal legal rights. But Little Russian activists, who, after all, had been demanding the liberation of the children of Rus for many decades, spun this catchphrase of liberation in their own unique way. For them, it was not the Tsarist state that was the primary exploiter of the masses, the source of their woe. It was non-Orthodox populations, Polish Catholics, but especially Jews. And so Pikhnow, as that the editor of the Kievan, became the major spokesman for this position. Vitaly Shulgin, who had founded the newspaper, had long since died. And Pikhnow was joined in this campaign in the Kievan by Shulgin's son. So we have another Shulgin now, Vasily, and you see him here. He always has a fabulous mustache, so he's easy to recognize. Amidst the trials of 1905, the contributors to the Kievan began describing themselves in a new way. They began referring to themselves simply as Russian nationalists. But the Little Russian paper that was so ingrained in Little Russian patriotism that was so ingrained in this paper and from this Russian nationalist movement that was beginning to build on it never disappeared from this organ. The Southwest Russian nationalists continued to speak proudly about the Rus heritage of their native region, claiming that it would claim all the Rus children from foreign threats as it always had. The Kiev Russian Nationalist Revolution of 1905 was not merely rhetorical. It was also embraced by ordinary people who took to city streets. On October 18, 1905, the Tsar issued huge political concessions, announcing that he would guarantee his subjects basic civil rights and call a national parliament. Also, this imperial parliament is also confusedly called a Duma. As citizens gathered in the city center to discuss the momentous political events of the day, chants began to erupt from the crowd. Mostly workers, that liberation was incomplete. Russian people, they chanted, would never be truly emancipated until they were liberated from Jews. And here you see a rather remarkable picture. You note, again, they convene in front of the city Duma, this kind of lightning rod for criticism. And I think the picture shows you both the scale and the intense emotion of that day. This crowd got so rowdy that the military was called in to break it up. And people began to head back to those peripheral districts, building on those neighborhood networks that they'd created to promote political change, and now using them instead to organize violence. A pogrom aimed at wealthy businessmen and working class Jews alike began immediately, and it lasted for 3 days, with the pogromists pausing only to rally at the headquarters of the newspaper, the Kievan. This was became the costliest outbreak of violence in the entire empire of that year, which had more than 800 pogroms across the Russian Empire. So in 1905, the people of Kiev themselves spoke. In both words and action, they declared themselves Russian, a word that they, like the intellectuals of the Kievan, now defined as an expression of their loyalty to the Tsar, the church, and the state, and defined in opposition to the revolution, which they in turn blamed on foreign agitators, who were in fact right their neighbors in essence. Now, in the aftermath of 1905, the Southwest Russian nationalists dramatically expanded their organizational capacity. In 1908, Shulgin and Pikhno helped to found the Kiev Club of Russian Nationalists, a centralized organization that aimed to bring nationalists from all classes together. So this is a picture of the Kiev Club greeting the Tsar on his visit to Kiev in 1911, and you note from the dress the variegation. You also note the woman. This group allowed women in and really highlighted that as well. This group had a cultural mission to raise awareness of Russian culture in this contested borderland. Although, in fact, yet again, the Russian culture was, in fact, the culture of the borderlands. So the heroes that these men celebrated were Shevchenko, Kulish, Kostomarov, and these other intellectuals who'd been busted in 1840 as part of that secret society. This group also had a political aspect. It lobbied to create a, quote, Russia for Russians, a slogan that demanded both the greater engagement of the Orthodox East Slavs in government and a diminution of the role of other groups in economics and politics. And it ultimately went on to establish chapters across the entire empire. Nationalists managed as well to consolidate a mass political following driven by the sheer will of their party activists in these years. Kiev activists created a dense network of nationalist tea houses, workers' unions, and self-help organizations. Working with village priests, they expanded their purview to rural areas as well, and Shulgin was a mastermind in both these urban and rural campaigns. So to recapitulate, right, I don't see this nationalist tide emanating from the Southwest as a top-down project of Russification. Rather, I see it primarily as a grassroots movement that aims to promote the welfare of ordinary Orthodox people, even as it's claiming to support Tsarist traditions and imperial unity. And I also see it as a localist movement that's celebrating the special role that the southwestern borderlands have played in protecting the East Slavs over the centuries. Not a small amount of this Russian nationalist agitation still, in 1910, is taking place in Ukrainian, in the countryside. And the leaders and followers of this movement all remain primarily ethnic Ukrainian, or Little Russian, as they're calling themselves. These mobilizational efforts soon yielded fruit. In 1906, the Russian nationalists won their first electoral victories in the Kiev City Duma, and also they claimed Kiev's seat to the Imperial Duma. In 1907, they became the dominant party in the Southwest. So 36 of 41 representatives from that region proclaimed themselves Russian nationalists. By 1908, they created a formal political party that called itself the All-Russian Nationalist Union. And here again, you see this party encompassed Ukrainian-speaking peasants, priests, nobles, urban professionals, sort of everyone you can imagine. He's not on this page, but Shulgin managed to get himself elected into the Imperial Duma through this party as well. And this party is still continuing on this campaign that Southwest Nationalists have carried on for many years. All right. By 1910, this party, All-Russian National Union, had become the second largest party in the Imperial Duma. So we're now the second largest party in the empire. And I've argued that also this quiet but very consequential nationalist revolution had taken place locally, right, on the right bank. At this point, these nationalists were feeling so powerful that they began to branch out further beyond their southwestern stronghold. And it helped that they had gained support and sympathetic ear in the highest reaches of government. In 1910, Stolypin, who by then was acting as essentially prime minister, began to treat these Southwest Russian nationalists as his most loyal partner in governance. He worked alongside Pikhno and Shulgin to draw up a whole campaign to nationalize governance in the western borderlands. That is to create zemstva, right, rural self-governance organizations that would give broad self-governance privileges to East Slavs and limit the influence of Poles and Jews. Stolypin and his nationalist allies faced fierce resistance in this campaign, but they ultimately enacted the reform through emergency decree in 1911. So this is a kind of high point of the nationalist tide. So stepping back, the success of Russian nationalism on the Southwest frontier is a remarkable story and gives us, I think, new perspective on imperial history. Historians have often treated the Tsarist state as a behemoth that imposed its will on society and that sought to centralize and standardize everything. Here, however, we've seen how a small group of provincial intellectuals reimagined the empire on their own terms and managed to shape politics at a very high level across the empire. The story of the Southwest Russian nationalists proves that even in an autocratic system, Tsarist subjects could officially set agendas and mobilize to attain them. And it reveals that a vibrant and powerful civil society could flourish and accomplish much in Russia. But I think to point to the success, right, the presence of this civil society is not to argue that Russia was on the path to becoming a democratic, liberal, rule of law state. Quite the contrary, as I've already hinted with my discussion of the pogrom, political networks and civic activity could encourage violence and ideological polarization just as much as they could facilitate peaceful political protest. So, as I stated, the Southwestern nationalists reached the height of their power in 1911. And this is the exact moment at which we began to see the high cost of this movement. The very week that Stolypin enacted that Western Zemstvo bill through emergency decree, the body of a 13-year-old boy was found in Kiev. This murder was one of many grisly crimes reported in what was then a very dangerous city, but it garnered an unusual amount of attention. Radical segments of the city's Russian nationalists seized on the murder, claiming that the boy, who was found with numerous puncture wounds by a sharp object, was the victim of a ritual murder conducted by Jews. And here you see a pamphlet that was handed out with this very graphic picture making this claim. So this notion that the children of Rus face existential threats from outsiders now takes on this more radical form than ever, right, with this claim that the city's Jews are physically attacking and murdering small children. Eventually, a Jewish worker employed at the enterprise near where the body was found was arrested. His name was Mendel Bayliss. And although imperial officials were at first rather dubious of these blood ritual claims, they faced so much pressure from these mobilized nationalists that they eventually went along and they placed Bayliss on trial. The so-called Bayliss case became a scandal that disgraced the entire empire. For liberals and conservatives alike, it embodied the abusive and unreformable nature of the Tsarist regime. And after this moment, many people of all political stripes really lose their faith in Tsarism. So this is the case, I would argue, where interest group politics and the civil society mobilization for not good purposes really spun out, right? Discrediting the very government that the nationalists claimed to support and further dividing local residents against one another. Southwestern Russian nationalism was unstable in one other sense as well. It showed how official toleration and sometimes sponsorship was critical. I've showed how official toleration and sometimes sponsorship were critical to the ability of the Little Russian idea to flourish and adapt. But as early as the 1870s, some longtime Little Russian activists began to interpret local patriotism and this defense of the periphery in their own way. That is, they began to see these local peculiarities not as representing the essence of a Rus nation that that unified the East Slavs. Rather, they saw these peculiarities as evidence of what they called a separate nation named Ukraine. And their belief gradually evolved that this nation of Ukraine needed to be liberated from the empire. Now, this Ukrainian nationalist viewpoint that emerges from the Little Russian idea, it would remain confined to a tiny group as late as the early 20th century. We're talking about a few dozen people. But interestingly enough, one of its chief spokesmen is also a Shulgin. His name is Alexander. He is Vasily's cousin. So these two cousins take this family heritage, their pride in these local peculiarities and language in very different directions, right? With one becoming a Russian nationalist and one becoming a Ukrainian nationalist. In the end then, for all their success in engaging Tsarist subjects and in reframing politics, the Little Russian idea and the Russian nationalist project to which it gave rise proved difficult for the empire and its political structures to contain. Indeed, in the empire's last years, this idea and the Russian nationalist movement in the Southwest really collapsed upon itself. Vasily Shulgin, the Russian, was absolutely outraged by the Bayliss trial. He complained that silly medieval legends about blood rituals were a distraction from the real threats that he believed Jews posed to East Slavs, and he complained that they detracted from the so-called sensible anti-Semitism that he hoped to promote. We can debate how sensible it is. During World War I, which of course was a disaster for the Tsarist Empire, Shulgin lost his last shards of faith in the regime and became a vocal critic of the whole system. And appropriately enough, in February 1917, he was one of the two Duma delegates who traveled to a railroad car on the Eastern Front to accept the Tsar's resignation, which marked the end of the 300-year-old Romanov dynasty. Here you see Shulgin with his distinctive mustache, third from the left, in an artist's rendering of the scene. So perhaps it's appropriate that a leader of a movement that had unwittingly destabilized the empire that it intended to save was present at the moment of its very demise. By 1918, Ukraine had plunged into a bloody civil war that killed many of the protagonists of this story, that forced others to flee, and that left the city of Kiev in ruins. Both Shulgin cousins were among those who fled, continuing their struggle for control of the Rus lands in emigration. Alexander Shulgin, the Ukrainian, became the representative of the independent Ukrainian government that briefly emerged from 1917. And then after the Bolsheviks took over, he fled to Paris, where he stayed until he died in 1940. Vasily, the Russian, and many of his colleagues from the Kiev Club of Russian Nationalists also fled west. Shulgin went first to Berlin and then ended up in Yugoslavia. Radicalized by war and revolution, Shulgin revived the little idea yet again in immigration, using it to question the legitimacy of the Ukrainian state championed by his cousin, as well as that of the Bolshevik regime, which he characterized as a Jewish dictatorship determined to destroy Rus values. By the mid-20s, Shulgin looked to fascism as the force best positioned to accomplish the reclamation of his homeland. And in 1938, on the occasion of Hitler's annexation of Austria, the Anschluss, Shulgin published this pamphlet called The Anschluss and Us. In this pamphlet, he argues that the right bank not only gave rise to the idea of the Russian nation, but also invented fascism. He proudly identified Bogdan Khmelnytsky as the world's first fascist and celebrated the Hetman's efforts to create out of the heterogeneity of empire, and this is his quote in the original German, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. So in the end, the Little Russian idea proved more resilient than the empire that had created it. And it proved surprisingly adaptable to this new world of political extremes that was coalescing in the interwar. I'm going to take just a minute to end with a few words about the situation in Ukraine now, which, as you might imagine, is difficult to avoid with this topic. Ukrainian citizens are currently involved in a valiant struggle against a corrupt and repressive government. And here you see the front lines. Again, this is the same European square that I showed you before with Margolin's tram. We're just facing the other way. We were facing kind of that way in the other picture I showed you. I have many friends and colleagues in the street, and I sincerely, I think like everyone else, hope for a peaceful resolution to the conflict. But in light of today's stories, I do have a lot of trepidations. The removal of President Yanukovych from office would be a first step towards solving Ukraine's problems. But I think that beneath the corrupt politicians, the clan politics, the oligarchs, Russian influence, there lies a very old and a very unresolved identity crisis, one that hinges on the very question I've been talking about today: what is Ukraine and who are Ukrainians? For now, at least, the country seems hopelessly split on this question. One half insists that Ukraine is Ukraine and Ukraine is European, while another half embrace a worldview that I would actually really trace back to this Little Russian idea and see many similarities. Ukrainians who have opposed this protest movement in the streets of Kyiv, who want Ukraine tightly bound to Russia, are often lampooned in coverage of the crisis as pawns of Putin, as hapless victims of criminal gangs. There's even been, rife on both sides. People are charging that people in the streets are acting that way because they're being paid by someone else, right? But in my view, these people are not brainwashed. They're not being paid. Maybe some of them are. They're not cowed by fear. Rather, I think many of them are expressing deeply held personal beliefs about their place in the world that have a historical tradition that date back many hundreds of years. So if Ukraine is to have a peaceful, united, and democratic system, I think it will need to do more than unseat its current government. It will also need to cope with the legacy of the Little Russian idea and the anti-liberal mass politics that it has spawned. So thank you for your attention.